Hey guys, can you hear me at the back? All good. Okay, excellent. So, thanks for coming today. I think there's quite a bit of interest in terms of Exchange 2010. Although it's been out in the market for a long time, I suspect there's still a lot of Exchange 2003 out there today, and maybe 2007. Actually, let me just ask quickly, how many of you are actually looking to upgrade from 2003 to 2010? Just a quick raise. Wow, that's about right. 2007? Oof. Well, that's almost... And the
notes.
Rest?
Notes.
Any group-wise notes? Anything else? No, it's all good. All right, well, so let me start by introducing myself. For those of you who haven't been to TechEd or haven't seen me present, my name is Colin Lee. I was a long-time Microsoftie for a while, and as you can see, there's a slight change recently. Moved to Dell 2 or 3 months ago. And I've got with me Sofyan, who's also with Dell. So my role is the, I suppose, a global solution architect at Dell, helping customers look at unified comms. So that basically is Exchange, it's Link, it's Office 365. But my background really is spanning all of the Exchange stuff, going all the way back to the 4.0 days. And Sofyan obviously has a lot of experience as well in the field in terms of deploying. And so today I was hoping to give you guys some historic perspective on things, in terms of what some of the things you can actually look out for and some of the best practices that you should encounter as you go through the process. So hopefully as you actually get out of the session, you won't get all the information you need, but enough pointers to take you on that journey and actually, I suppose, areas for you to focus on as you start that journey to 2010. Because to be very honest with you, I've seen many iterations of Exchange, you know, being built from the 4.0, 5.0, and 5.5 was a phenomenal sort of platform as well. And I reckon 2003, but then 2010 is basically take it off, you know, take it to the next level and beyond, because the amount of stuff that's in there and the amount of savings that you can actually have in the organization, as well as being able to sort of provide those enhanced capabilities to end users, is out of this world. So I mean, it's night and day. Look. There's not a lot we can actually cover in the hour or so, so I'm going to really sort of speed through a lot of the processes and then just cover off at a high level. Scott's here. He's got a session later on in terms of high availability, so I do recommend that if you're interested in 2010, that's an absolute session you need to get into there, right? Because you're going to get a lot of knowledge in terms of what you should do from a high availability perspective. So what I'm going to start off with, I'm going to split it up in a little bit, so I'll do the first half and I'll let Sofyan sort of take care of some of the deeper dives into the technology. But I'll give you guys a bit of a historic perspective, overview, and then some of the best practices in terms of just the initial deployment there. Yeah, basically talked about the session, what you're going to get out of it. Look, Exchange has become a fairly complicated beast. There's a lot of moving parts, but also Microsoft has done a phenomenal job in terms of ensuring that the information, pardon me, the information's out there. So if you know where to look, you can do it yourself. If you're in a fairly complex environment, a fairly large environment, you can actually look to a partner to help out, or a Microsoft MCS to help out as well along the way, because obviously the guys have been doing it on a, you know, daily, monthly, and has actually got lots of experience, and they can actually help you through some of those hurdles you might encounter along the way. So I'm going to start off with some historic information, really around giving you perspective what you have today for those of you who are in 2003 and what those changes have actually evolved to in 2007 and then 2007 to 2010 there. So one of the key things that you'll find historically is that Exchange 2003 is a monolithic stack. So it's an all-in-one box, essentially, with all the components there. You may have the idea of, you know, the front-end, back-end, but in essence, it wasn't a modular approach. So Microsoft sort of decided to take a different approach to doing 2007 and change the architecture dramatically and actually build into the modular components that you see today in 2010. It started in 2007, so you've got all these roles such as client access server, hub transport, the mailbox server, the edge, the UM. All of these actually have specific functionalities. The code is actually written specifically for that, and it's modular enough so that you can actually either have a consolidated view or actually take them out to separate roles on separate servers, or if you want to do virtualization, do that as well. So that was the start of the actual architectural change for Microsoft around the modular approach, and it's continued there onwards. Now, I'll talk a little bit about best practices later on and how some of that's changed as well along with technology. Some of the other things that has actually changed, and for me, I think it's actually been the biggest change that Microsoft has done from the 2003-2007 is to actually go to 64-bit computing. Right, one of the deployments that you have traditionally in 2003 is really with a 32-bit operating system, you're limited to 4 gig of memory. Right? Essentially, that's my recommendation to all of my customers through the times that I've actually deployed 2003 and actually advised them on 2003 is that don't go over 4 gig of memory. Because guess what? As you actually add 8, 12, or 16, you're not going to use it, right? It actually has some performance degradation sort of ramification as well if you actually deploy a system with 16 gig of RAM. And so technology sort of revamped up all the way up to, you know, faster processors, more memory. Memory became a lot cheaper. So stock standard would have been, you know, something at about 8 or 12 gig of RAM at that time. And Exchange couldn't take advantage of that. So by going to the 64-bit platform, Exchange was able to leverage more memory. That more memory sort of translated into a few other things as well, which really became compelling for an organization to think about, and that is reducing the performance requirements there in your storage subsystem. So in terms of what you were deploying in 2003, you would have been deploying on high-end SANs, right? And if you weren't deploying on high-end SANs, guess what? You're going to start getting issues, and those issues translated into poor performance for your end user. So all of those things actually came about as a result of the limitation, the amount of memory we could actually use, and just the architecture of 2003, lots of little small transactions, right, required performance in the back end to supplement that as well. So by actually going to 64-bit, the memory recommendation or the memory capable of being accessing was huge, right? Although, I suppose from a cost perspective, there was a sweet spot, and that sweet spot was probably around the 32 gig mark there, give or take a little bit, potentially going to 64, depending on your scenario. And by doing that, one of the things it did for you was around the storage, and it allowed you to actually think about looking at the non-tier one storage, at least the secondary sort of storage in terms of direct attached storage as well. And so as a proof point, Microsoft actually went from 100 meg mailboxes. For those of you on 2003, I would find it almost incredible to see anything beyond 500 meg in those environments there. And I mean, anyone had anything over about 500 meg in terms of mailboxes in 2003? One or two? Are you from the law firms where you had unlimited mailboxes? Right. So the only guys I actually saw that had over 500 meg mailboxes tend to be the law firms who want to actually have everything. And the largest, I suppose, size I actually encountered in the field in 2003 days was somewhere in the region of about 25 to 30 gig, right, because they actually stored everything. But it was such a mad environment to manage and actually work in. So by going to 2003, leveraging 64-bit operating system, you started getting more access to, you know, faster pool of memory, therefore looking at different storage, and therefore giving your end users some benefits of the back-end upgrade that you're doing there. In terms of some of the other things that's changed, one pet peeve for me was FreeBSY. In 2003, right, you're relying on FreeBSY in public folders. Now, that could translate to a few issues in terms of the end user experience, and that is you could have, like, well, in terms of updated information, if you've got a fairly complex deployment, your FreeBSY is actually in your public folders, and it was dependent on the public folder replication. Now, if that's going across different routing groups and different sites and whatnot, you could actually have lag in terms of your FreeBSY updates of up to about an hour or possibly 2 hours. I've actually seen three in the field. So by actually looking at someone's calendar, booking someone's calendar, you could be actually having something that's 3 or 4 hours out of date. Now, generally, you'll find that it's up to date by about 15 minutes within that 15-minute cycle. But even then, you're not getting that sort of real translation there in terms of real-time access to FreeBSY that you do. So 2007 gave you the ability to actually do real-time FreeBSY. It also translated into a few other things as well, such as auto-discovery, the ability for you to sort of look at not having to manage Outlook profiles. That was an enormous boom for auto-discovery. So the idea that you can actually get all your profile information on the fly, changes that occur on the fly, you get it in terms of even moving mailboxes, server going down, updates to the back end, would also come in through auto-discovery as a background thread that gets updates every 60 seconds or so. So that was a key change for me. The other thing that really helped, I suppose, Microsoft move into the next steps of automation is leveraging PowerShell. It's actually gone through that sort of change from MMC and all of the snap-ins that you might use or the management console, changed to PowerShell, and it was, I suppose, the first actual application that leveraged PowerShell to do all of its automation. So all of the functionalities you had was actually built around PowerShell. All of the UIs you had in the Exchange Management Console, every one of them actually called a commandlet to actually execute. And what you found probably in those, if you deployed 2007, was that the UI was actually a subset of the complete capabilities you had out of PowerShell as well. And that's changed over time, as Microsoft heard from the field, right? That's changed. Last thing, just quickly on that, is the last thing on the next sort of component is really the vision that Microsoft have in terms for the developers. And that's really around changing the perception of all of the APIs there. It really is talking about what we're going to take into the future, and it's leveraging Exchange Web Services, right? So it's the web services moving forward as a strategic option. It did support those older legacy XLADB in 2007, but the strategic vision for Microsoft was Exchange Web Services, and Exchange 2010 has actually taken that to the next step there. So there were some of the things, I may not have covered everything, but those are just a couple of highlights for me. But in 2007 to 2010, for you guys who are on 2010, I think there's still value there. There's a perception out in the field that if you're on 2007, why would I upgrade to 2010? Honestly, I think there's a lot of value, and it comes into a few things, cloud being one of those key aspects that you're looking at, enabling you to, I suppose, look at your vision 18 months down the track, 36 months down the track in terms of where you want to be. And 2010 is a platform for you. So when Microsoft started development process for Exchange 2010, it really built it on with the cloud in mind, right? So its whole build process was to actually support 100 million plus mailboxes in the cloud. And then as it got closer to general availability, it actually forked out down to the on-premise sort of solution that you see today. And so, you know, the ability for you to have both, you know, on-premise, in the cloud, or a hybrid solution, or even for some of those of you who are actually on an older platform and want to have that experience, there is actually a SKU that allows you to do transitioning, a version of Exchange that allows you to transition between doing the move mailboxes into the cloud. If you've been in the Office 365 sessions there, they'll talk all about that as well. The next area, and I think the biggest area, is really around high availability, right? So I didn't talk about what 2007 in the previous slide, but there was a big change from SEC, right? So basically shared storage there, single copy cluster, the idea that you had multiple nodes sharing a single copy of the actual LUN, and when one node fails, the other one actually had took over exclusive lock on that. And guess what? In 2003, in your high availability story, you had two parts to a high availability story, and that is data availability and service availability, right? So 2003 gave you the service availability, the idea that if a node fails, the other one actually brought it online. But if you had data corruption, you had to resort to backup. So there were issues there. And 2007 started with the change in that you would actually have continuous cluster replication, standby cluster replication, local continuous replication. Not that very many people actually took that up. But the idea is that you have active copy, which would then use a transaction log replication into a passive copy. Both copy would actually be in a consistent state and up to date. Should one fail, the other one actually can pick it up, and now you have both service and data availability. There was a limitation in that, it was a more of a one-to-one relationship that you have a active and a passive node. 2010 took that to the next level with database availability group. Now, it's an unfortunate acronym if you happen to be a farmer and whatnot, so life as it is, right? But, you know, DAG has become much talked about in 2010. And if you're in relatively small organization, database availability group would be a key aspect of that that technology that you would implement. So the idea is that you take away that limitation that you had with a one-to-one relationship, and also build in the whole CCR and SCR sort of combination into one. So you have both the high availability option and your disaster recovery option built into database availability group. So the ability to do HA in your main data center and then expand out to another alternate data center for disaster recovery under the one DAG sort of umbrella makes a lot of sense. Now, there was also one thing that's not on the slide that I think that Microsoft has done as well, is actually change the schema in the store process. And in that, a lot of the actual transaction that occurred was still random, tiny little random, actions or transactions there. In 2010, they tried to make a lot of that more sequential and have actually succeeded to a point where by going from random to sequential, you're actually reducing the performance once again. And the biggest change around that was your storage once again. So you still had the option of leveraging high-end, fast SAN, T tier 2 storage with direct access and a high-performing disk as well with SAS drives. But with 2010 and changing the performance improvements there, it's actually gone from 2003 in terms of a 90% change in 2010. And what that really translates to for you that are trying to actually deploy 2010 today means you can potentially look at even local storage using SATA, depending on the way you would go through. So the idea that high-end storage, tier 2, tier 3, going all the way down to just a bunch of disks. Now, there are a couple of caveats you need to think about, and what I'll do is I'll let Scott take that to the next level in the next session there. But it gives you options. If you've already made the investment in your storage subsystem, it makes sense to continue leveraging it or even look at to augment that alternative and add in some additional nodes there. So with Database Value Grid, you can actually have up to 16 nodes, and that gave you the flexibility to say, you know what, my senior execs are looking down at me and how I'm deploying all that infrastructure. I'm not using an active-passive sort of scenario anymore, and I don't have 50% of my servers actually running idle. That's the perception, although the techie guys would say, no, it's not running idle, it's part of a solution. But that's the perception. So with 2010, you're raising that to the next level, and management's basically saying, guess what? You're running active across the load, right? And now you're actually starting to save them money in terms of actually looking at maybe just a bunch of disks with SATA drives where it becomes a viable option for you to deploy. The kind of dollars you're saving from a SATA drive and all of that, we're talking decreases of about a tenfold, right, in terms of cost. So you can dramatically save dollars in that particular area. So moving on, the other thing that really has changed is the ability to access the actual database or your mailbox. There's an abstraction layer that Microsoft put on there. It's basically the RPC client access. So everything is coming access. Every client access is actually going via the CAS now. There is one little tiny caveat there. Your public folder access is still going into your public folder store directly, but all of your client access is coming over your RPC CAS access point there. Now what that means is now failover in terms of high availability gives you the ability to say, well, you know what? If a server, a store, a component fails on one server, I can actually flip over to another one ready and it's actually up and running within 30 seconds or less, potentially even, give or take, right? So the amount of failover time actually decreased dramatically. So, I mean, uptime goes through the roof. As I mentioned before, the development sort of thing is Microsoft has basically stopped development on some of the legacy APIs there, EXLADB, WebDAV, and also CDOEX and all of that. So as you move forward in 2010, any legacy stuff that you need to sort of wean off, do so before you go to 2010 because you don't have the ability to leverage anything other than Exchange Web Services there. In terms of what you've got in the installation and some of the caveats, number one thing for you guys to think about is that you don't need Windows Server 2008 or R2 domain controller in global catalogs, right, moving forward. You still can actually deploy it if you haven't got a project in place to actually go upgrade to 2003, upgrade from 2003, you're fine. You can continue to running in 2003 forest functional mode and you're going to be okay for a while. Although, keep in mind, life cycle wise, you've only got a couple of years left before that 10-year expiration for Windows 2 of 2003 there. My recommendation, if you have the ability, 2008 or 2008 R2 would be great. One little tip, if you think the RODC, or read-only domain controller, is a viable option for Exchange in a branch site or something like that, it's not. You need a full running version of the domain controller. So just keep that in the back of your mind. I've actually seen some literature that's sort of spawned in either on the internet or somewhere. Not necessarily true, right? So guys, just keep in mind, look at the Microsoft TechNet as a source of truth for that information. Your Exchange servers, if you're in interop, everything, all your servers, recommendation is up to at least SP2 in terms of interoperability, so make sure you do that as part of your first step. Your server requirements there, a couple of things to keep in mind. If you're running Windows Server 2008, you've got all of the actual server components you need to install. You can run it on 2008 R2, both either standard or enterprise. The only component you need from an enterprise perspective is if the server is actually part of a database availability group, right? Because the clustering component requires the enterprise version of Windows. A couple other things, so Windows Management Framework, .NET 3.51, all of IIS, A couple of key things to remember out of all of that, if you are actually going through a deployment process and you haven't got an SOE, I would go with Server 2008, R2, SP1. There's a couple of hot fixes that you need, and from a client access perspective, some of that, it's a Windows hot fix from an R2, all of that's actually built into SP1. Right? So it makes your life a little bit easier. In terms of what's available for moving forward, if you were deploying Exchange 2010 today, there is a roll-up for SP1 in Exchange 2010. It was a re-release and it got re-released on the 27th of July recently. So Microsoft actually explained itself. There was, I've worked with the Sustain engineering team for so long. I mean, they're an incredible team. Those guys have actually gone through an enormous amount of testing. However, there are going to be minute cases they're going to miss, and this would happen to be just one of them. And they do not recall any roll-ups, ad hoc, right? It generally is a corruption class issue before they actually pull the roll-up. And so they've gone through all that process, they've fixed the issue. There is actually a blog by the product team about it and what actually happened there. So roll-up 4 is great. If you happen to be on RTM, roll-up 5 is still out there. There is a wiki link there that talks about all of the version information, all of the roll-ups. That goes all the way back to day dot. Okay, so SP1 also introduces a couple of new experiences that's worth noting here. In terms of upgrading from a setup, the actual server components that you need to install out of the box, say if you're on, if you need to run them independently in Server Manager in 2008 or in R2, a separate process there, the actual upgrade process allows you to actually do another switch to basically say, install those components for me without actually me separately exiting the actual setup program, running the actual commands to actually set the components. I've actually installed Exchange numerous times, and it's a pain in the ass if you're actually setting up a lab where the actual components, I've got to install that component, you need to install that component before you run the setup again, so on and on. So SP1 gave you the ability to install those components for you automatically. In the actual setup process, there's a checkbox which allows you to say, go and actually do everything for me, right? So it automates the whole process. Another setup worth noting, there's a few other things. I haven't actually taken all of them out there, but this setup is actually for more of the complex environments out there where you've got an AD team and you've got a messaging team. And, with the Exchange Management Console, where you create a new mailbox, you can actually create a user before you create the mailbox, or you can actually associate a mailbox to a user. Here, you can actually ensure there is a delineation in terms of the delegation process there, so that as you go through the setup process, there is a checkbox which allows you to basically say, the Exchange guys cannot touch my AD environment, to ensure that they can't actually create those objects because I've got an AD team, all right, an admin team that looks after everything. So that gives you the ability to go and look at some of those capabilities there. I don't know too many organizations, but generally it's the top end of town. Very few organizations have that. Nowadays it's more cross-pollination. It's just processes internally that allows you to separate the administration there. But most teams that are administering AD generally actually work with the messaging environment as well. Now, a problem that we've encountered, Microsoft encountered, and a lot of partners have encountered is that there's still a lot of Outlook 2003 out there today. Right? For those of you who's still on Outlook 2003, I just want to get an idea. Well, there's still quite a few. Yeah, okay. I mean, recommendation for me, and also I suspect from a lot of the partners in Microsoft in general, upgrade to Outlook 2010 if possible, if you're going there, right? If possible. However, if you can't do it right now, just a couple of things to think about. First thing is really the actual client-server communication. By default, Exchange 2010 enforces encryption from client to server. In the good old days of 2003 and 2000, so client and server in 2003 days, it's basically RPC communication from client server. And it's an encoding mechanism, it's not encryption. So if you're smart enough to actually sniff the traffic, you can actually decode the RPC packets to actually see the actual data that was transmitted from the client to the server. So you could read your CEO's email if it wasn't encrypted, if you had the access to the network. Now, moving forward to 2010, right, they've turned on encryption by default and has actually caused a lot of angst in the Outlook 2003 world, where the communication actually causes all sorts of issues there. And to get around that, I mean, it's a basic thing. It's a checkbox in the Outlook 2003 profile, but it causes a lot of problems. How do you actually manage all of that? Now, you can actually create a profile and go out and actually push those group policies out there to actually update that. That's possible. The other one, and something that's not such a great idea, is to actually turn off the required encryption on the client access. You can do that. It solves some of your problems, but there's a security issue or security implication that you guys got to think about. One other thing that Microsoft has changed is the ability to actually to use UDP, the notification for you, in terms of updating when you get new emails and all of that. So when 2010 first came out, you got Outlook 2003 clients there. Lots of issues around, oh, okay, I've sent an email, I'm expected to receive this email, I've actually done something, but I'm not seeing it in the interface. Something's wrong there. And that's because a lot of the actual push notification from UDP wasn't there. They've actually put it back into the system with roll-up SP1, roll-up 3. My recommendation, go to roll-up 4 if you can, but at bare minimum, roll-up 3. There is one other thing that you guys may encounter as you go through this process with Outlook 2003 and also encryption from client to server is WAN accelerators. Right? So WAN accelerators is I suspect if you've got some low-speed links, you might be using that. If you set up encryption from client and server, WAN accelerators will give you 1% optimization, right? If that doesn't work. So for you, for those of you who do have those deployed, think about the idea that, you know, leave it unencrypted, let the WAN optimization to actually take care of that, or talk to the WAN optimization vendors, because today you can actually offload the certificate onto those devices. So they do the certs actually on the device, so you can still have the client-server encryption. They decrypt it on the actual device. You get the optimization coming across. So I don't recommend it, but if you've got it, there are ways to work around it. Just keep that in mind as something that as you go through, where you've still got 2003 there in your environment. So I'm just quickly going to go through a high-level process, and I'll let Sofiane actually dive into the details as you transition through those steps there. So when you look at upgrading to 2010, your first thing you really do need to do is you look at your internet-facing sites to start off with, right? So you basically upgrade all your servers to SP2, whether it be 2003 or 2007, install a small portion of your users infrastructure of 2010, not your users, just your infrastructure in Exchange 2010. Set up all of the connectivity that you require, such as auto discovery, and then possibly let your legacy URL as you need to if you're on 2003, and look at getting a certificate using subject alternate names, right? So one certificate with multiple CNAMEs there that covers all of your scenarios going through that process. So, I mean, from a cert perspective, it costs a little bit more, but in the longer run, it costs a lot less for you. And it's a lot less management, it's a lot less overhead, and you've got one certificate to manage overall from all of your Exchange infrastructure. Potentially possible to even look at that to take on board the link stuff as well. A couple of caveats there in terms of that whole process. So once you've set up the whole process from in terms of the third step, your certificate's all ready, everything's all set up, right? Switch over URL to your Exchange 2010 environment. Your end user's oblivious, right? They'll get redirected or they'll get proxy depending on the scenario that you need. And so in terms of impact to your end users, it's a small switch between that process of going across of using ISA or TMG. It's a small outage to get you across to change those URL, pointing to a different set of servers then. Basically, move user as you've got the process going through, and then look at decommissioning those servers and then upgrading your internal sites as well. So a couple of things. Moving on to more useful tools to consider as you go through that process. There is a lot of tools that Microsoft made. There's a specific team that runs and actually creates those teams. Phenomenal guys there. We've actually had one of the developers out here, would have been about 5 or 7 years ago. I mean, they're a really bunch of smart guys who've actually taken all the learnings from the field partners, but more so from the support organization in Microsoft, where they've seen all these issues. Here, how can I actually help automate all of those things, or how can I actually use a tool to actually go and find out all that information? So I'm going to quickly go through, and I'm getting, I know I'm waffling on, and I think it's useful information to give you some historic perspective, but I'd rather give you guys the insight into all of the tools that's out there. So there is a tool for the pre-deployment assistant there. It helps you look at your topology today and get it ready for the Exchange 2010. So ensuring that all you've got some of the prereqs that you need to go through, or if you're an older AD domain, it needs to actually get up to Windows 2003 Forest Function Memory first. Then the key one for I suspect for most of you is the actual deployment assistant. It's a tool that actually goes and takes your requirements, walks you through the process, gives you a list of checklists in terms of those you need to think about, and then at the end, you can take an output of, if you haven't already copied it, a checklist to go, well, these are the things I need to do before I go through the Exchange 2010 process there. There is a troubleshooting assistant there for, in terms of looking at performance, in terms of database issues, in terms of actual mail flow issues there. This tool, it basically automates the task for you. Go and say, look, I've got an issue with performance. Go and gather all of the actual necessary performance counters, event logs and all of that, and give me a way to look to either resolve it or actually give you the actual root cause of that as well. So leverage those tools. Remote Connectivity Analyzer, brilliant tool. So for those of you who've ever gone through the process of even upgrading from 2003 to 2007, try and actually get all of the URLs right, making sure that your OWA and ActiveSync and all and Outlook Anywhere is connecting properly. Now how do you test that? Very, very hard in terms of your own internal environment if you haven't got it set right. So this tool will go out and actually go through your internal setup. Right, you don't have to have a client out on the internet to go through it. It does all of the actual connection calls, and interrogates where you've actually gone right, gone wrong, warns you, you haven't got a certificate, auto-discovery is not set up, blah, 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 and so on. So it covers the range of internet connectivity, protocols that you need to actually verify without having to deploy a client out on the internet to validate that. Best Practice Analyzer, if you don't know about it, read up all about it, because guess what? These are the best practice or the rules that's been gathered over the years from Microsoft to say, in your Exchange environment as you deploy 2010, right, these are the things that has gone right, these are the things that's gone wrong, here's some of the areas and critical issues that you need to take care of as you go through the process. Don't use it once, use it multiple times, because as you finish the installation, run it once just to get, if you want to get some trend analysis or just see whether or not you've actually deployed correctly. So I'm going to quickly go through the deployment assistant. As you can see now, it's the on-premise, it's got the cloud, it's got the hybrid solution thinking about it. As you look at it, it asks you certain questions as you go through the process. You're upgrading from 2003, 2007, depending on, 2007, 2010, 2003, 2010, or the cloud stuff, or even a brand new installation. What are some of the things you need to think about? Certain questions that goes through, am I deploying UM, am I deploying other stuff? And as you can see, I don't know if I got a pointer, no, it may not. There's actually about 21 steps that goes through. Each one of those steps gives you, a set of information that you need to think about as you go through your upgrade process or even a new installation. And at the end, right, once you've done the installation, these are some of the post-installation tasks to validate and verify that your installation has gone through correctly. Now, Deployment Assistant is your best friend in the whole process as you go through that thing. Right at this point in time, you guys may be thinking, some of you guys might be twittering or whatever, or there's a bunch of other tools out there that you could potentially use. What I'm going to do is, off the top of my head, I reckon there's about another four tools that I haven't talked about. So I'm going to give you some giveaways, guys, some headsets. If you guys can send me an email to my address at the end of this, the first four guys that can give me the first four other tools that you should consider as part of the whole process, I'll give you a giveaway. So my address is colin_l@dell.com. There is about four out there, and there's been more, but I'll take the first four. All right. A couple of quick things before I hand over to Sofyan. These are just some PowerShell scripts. that will help you in terms of going through your troubleshooting or understanding your environments a little bit more. There is in SP1, there is actually a mailbox assistant. So actually, there is a mailbox assistant that looks after all of your calendaring information, making sure that your attendees and your, I suppose, the creator of the meeting, make sure they're in the right time zone, make sure they've got the right time in terms of actually creating the location and all that information. So there is an automated process that goes in and looks at all of the calendaring items to make sure they're actually in a consistent state. Now, this service can go up and down. There are some issues associated with it. There is a PowerShell script that allows you to go in and have a look at it, and from time to time, you know, if it's in a hung state every so often, it will alert and do something for you, allow you to actually go in and say, well, guess what? There's something wrong. Let's go take an action. Another issue that has actually hit Microsoft a lot of times, and that is your log LUN, or the amount of transaction logs that continue to grow and grow and grow due to some, I suppose, rogue process, rogue user, something that actually caused maybe a loop in your system there. Now, this PowerShell script will go in and interrogate and find out when your actual, your LUN is actually filling up in space. If it's less than 25% or whatever number that you actually use, there is actually a constant value that actually you can modify, and it can do something to it, right? So if it finds that it's actually a particular user that's actually causing this increase in transactions, and it's slowly loading up your transaction LUN, when you actually fill up with transactions, right, and you can't create any more transactions, right, your store process is going to eventually stop. All right, it's going to dismount. So in terms of being able to find that and looking at that, there is actually a PowerShell script to troubleshoot your data, the log growth. The next one is probably even more important, is to actually understand, this is actually part of SCOM, but you can actually run the actual PowerShell script independently to actually validate latency in your database, right? So a couple of things that can actually cause database latency issues, and that is you could have a bad disk, right? A disk that's almost coming close to the end of life, but it's still running, it's still hovering on a little bit, holding on. Those are the things that can actually cause latency between your access from the server down to the database. A user potentially going, a user basically actually causing multiple connections to the server, or even LDAP queries to the domain controller. So all of those things could be construed to cause some issue. The script can be run to actually see where those issues are, and actually identify and quarantine potentially even those users that are causing the high load. Or if you're actually having some issues with your database, there is a couple of things you think about. So if we look at the actual the disk transfer per second is less than the actual disk read rate threshold, and right, you've actually got low load, it means your disk is causing a few issues there. So your disk is coming to either end of life, it's dying, it's something there, right? Or if you've actually got an excessive amount of load from your end users, it can all call it out and actually flag a few things for you to think about and consider. Before I go on, this is probably my last little tidbit for you in terms of getting statistics. If you guys remember back in the days of 5.5 in the admin console, you can actually see client connectivity and all of that stuff, right? You don't get the same set of information in 2010. Well, with a registry hack, this is just, I've got it in there so you can refer to the slides. You can now get the log on statistics. So the idea behind that is, you know, the IP address, last log on time, client version, right? You can get all of that, dump it out there, and you can get your user profile, right? Where that IP range comes from, where it's all coming from, all of that kind of stuff is really valuable information from an admin. So use that as you need to. By default, Outlook 2007, Outlook 2010 does not enable that information, or doesn't actually pass that information to the server. Registry Hack will enable you to do that to allow the information for the server to collect. So I think I'm right at the end, but one last thing I just want to quickly finish off with is just some considerations overall, really high-level considerations overall, is if you're deploying Exchange 2010, there's enough technology out there today. The technology is advanced to a point where you should consider deploying multi-server roles, right? So having your CAS, your hub transport, and mailbox all in one box, and use that as the basic building block to go and expand as your organization expands, whether it's by acquisition or by increased load in your number of users there. And there's no reason why you should separate them today. There, not too many reasons, but consider that as your building block, unless you've actually got a key business requirement internally to actually push them out. I mean, if you look at the some of the reasonings I've seen is, oh, yeah, if I scale my number of users there and I'm actually using virtualization, I've taken my CAS and hub and take it out away, or maybe some licensing issues there. But realistically, if you look at it, I've done some calculations recently for a fairly large organization, 50,000 users, in terms of virtualization, right? If you do the numbers, you find that even in a virtualized environment there, you can get away with having multi-role servers in there. So think about just using that, because historically, the best practice recommendation was separate hub and CAS, and so and then use load balancing to actually do the hub and CAS component there and let HA take care of all the mailbox servers. I mean, in all my time, I actually think, you know, even for smaller environment, but even now going to larger environments, why not actually go and actually put everything together? Microsoft is advocating that. They've looked at it. They've seen deployments with it, and they can scale with it. Why would you do anything else? It's a lot less complex, a lot less number of servers, and from an administration overhead for administration perspective, a single unit to actually manage, right? CAS arrays. Now, one of the things that hit me a big time was in 2007 days, where the idea of CAS arrays wasn't very much advertised by Microsoft. And most people never, ever even considered doing a CAS array. It was just, I've got a couple of CAS servers out there, and guess what? It still worked, right? But more often than not, one server was getting pounded, right, from auto discovery and everything else. You didn't see an issue until the server went over. And in most environments, it was okay. But then Microsoft came out and realized there were issues and then made a big fuss about it, right? So you should do a CAS array. They also recommended, well, not recommended, they said there was possible to use NLB to do CAS array, but there are a number of issues that were critical enough where deploying a hardware load balancer makes a lot of sense. And there is actually cheaper entry-level load balancers in the marketplace where it makes it viable. And those, you know, the likes of F5, Kemp and whatnot, they're out there to a point where they're actually, if you're in a virtualized, they've got virtualized versions of that as well. So have a chat to those guys. Cost perspective goes through the roof for the high-end stuff, entry level for some of the cheaper guys there, and they're actually in all marketplaces. My last little thing is that, if you have an opportunity, leverage the cheaper storage because it makes sense. It's going to save you a bundle of money. I dare say go and look at just a bunch of disk if you're a little bit more progressive. If you're a little bit more conservative, you may want to steer away from that. But I, in all my deployments I'm going to go, my first recommendation is go with just a bunch of disks using SATA or SAS drives there to give you that cost savings there. If that's not a viable option, then scale it back a little bit. The last thing is think about database availability group and think about why you're doing HA and DR. We get a lot of confusions from customers who want to do HA and DR in one, right? Thinking, oh yeah, I can think about having multiple data center failovers and automated process. It doesn't happen. HA is a different concept to DR. DR is BCP or business continuity planning. The idea is that you're hitting a major disaster. You need to think about all the infrastructures, the processes, and the people in that, the whole sort of trinity, before you fail over into this DR scenario. There's probably a tiny corner case for those of you who may have, I would define as unlimited bandwidth and the ability to stretch between multiple data centers to do something that would combine HA and DR, but don't even think about it unless you've got a metropolitan LAN as opposed to a WAN out there, right? Lots of thinking around that. I'm sure Scott will go into a lot more detail in the next session about what you should think about. But for about 99% of the cases out there, 99.9% of the cases out there, HA and DR, right, are two separate things to consider. HA gives you the automatic failover. DR is a manual process that you need to go in and actually do something about. Right, whether it be a red button that's automating all of the set of scripts to actually file over the alternate data center, it's still a manual process. So with that, I'm going to hand over to Sofyan, who will go into a deep dive around all of the components you need to think about.
Thanks, Colin. So just to add on Colin's last few points, so something we see a lot with customers, especially we have a fair share of people that are still running Exchange 2003, is people still tend to rely on older best practices. So although we make all these recommendations, best practices are evolving every day. So make sure you go back often to TechNets and rely on your Microsoft contacts or your favorite partner to make sure the design or the implementation you are doing is up to the latest best practices. So namespace and URLs. So in 2010 world, it's really important to cater for your CAS deployment properly. So the CAS role is a most important role. You've heard it many, many times. So as Colin mentioned earlier, you would deploy CAS servers everywhere. That will work somewhat. But it's critical for you to plan your namespace properly. So here I'm showing the evolution of the namespace requirement and URLs over time from 2003 to 2007 and 2010. So it has gotten a little bit more simpler over time, but there is still a few things to consider as far as how you're going to manage the coexistence from an internet-facing side of things. So if I'm moving to 2010, how about my Windows Mobile client? So you have ActiveSync URLs that are slightly different. So how about web services? And also make sure you consider your client, because 2003 and 7 and 10 Outlook are using different protocols, so especially for FreeBSD services. So Outlook 2007 and above will rely heavily on AutoDiscover and EWS to do FreeBSD and out of office and all that sort of stuff. So the most important aspect is a legacy namespace in 2010. So what the legacy namespace does is it will help your legacy client, i.e. the people that are still on your 2003 server or 7, to be redirected whilst you've deployed 2010 and the migration is ongoing. So usually the way you do it is you configure those URLs beforehand, you redirect the IP to your reverse publishing technology, so whether it be TMG or UAG, for example, and then you will publish the new URLs on your 2010 server. So always start with obviously your internet-facing AD site. So again, most of you are on 2003. 2003 was relying on routing group connectors and all that sort of stuff. So AD might not be a huge component of your AD, your Exchange implementation. So make sure your AD will support that type of topology, because 2010 relies heavily on AD sites for routing and redirection and proxying if you have a multi-site deployment of Exchange. So yeah, have a good look at your AD environment first. The second common pitfall that we see very, very often on the field is certificates, because once again, Exchange 2010 is really smart. It will give you self-signed certificates. It will work internally somehow, maybe with a few pop-ups and warning. Make sure you plan accordingly for certificates, especially if you rely on external PKIs to deploy internal certificates, because there is a cost associated. So you don't want to reissue or buy new certificates because you missed a particular FQDN. On the same token, don't put all your server internal FQDN for obvious reason, because one of the recommendations we make is use as less certificates as possible. So you reduce your cost, you simplify configuration and maintenance, but at the same time, it's very easy to just put all the FQDN. So not only it's not a best practice, but that will break as you change your servers. So yeah, make sure you put all the required namespace. So deploying Exchange 2010 with CAS load balancing. So we've covered that a little bit before. So you can use NLB with the CAS, and it used to be an option with 2007. There is some limitation and some benefits and advantages in using both. So I'm going to try to summarize very quickly, but NLB has severe limitation as far as the mechanism and the stickiness used to load balance a particular user. There is port flooding issues, so make sure that if you go down the path of using NLB, your switch's infrastructure supports the NLB mechanism. There is service awareness issue. NLB is a pure network layer. So if you have a load balancing, an external load balancing solution, you can implement clever algorithm to work out on the application level if your service is up. So it will depend on your networking infrastructure. So that's the, you can use either of those. So that will be mostly driven by what you can do on the layer two, so between your two sites. So I've rarely seen people that were able to do layer two spanning with unicast across two sites, because usually it's a problem on a switching layer. So Microsoft doesn't recommend to do it as such, or neither it goes against it, but that's going to be a network problem in the first place. So if you are doing cross-site, cross-data center deployment, I would still highly suggest to stay away from that and make sure you have different AD sites, because the CAS array, the boundary of the CAS array and the load balancing is the AD site. So if you start to span your AD site, hence your exchange array across two sites, then you'll have all this cross traffic happening from your Outlook client to your CAS servers, because there is no practical way of controlling where your client, sorry, your CAS servers will be reached from the client. So you could have your mailbox server in data center one, and you could have a client hitting a CAS server in data center two, and you will have cross-site communication. So we can control that with SP1.
Actually, it'd be great to actually have a longer conversation about that, because there are other really sort of issues in terms of spanning multiple AD sites, right, trying to do that. Can we just take that offline at the end as well? I think we're just going to be a little bit short on time, but absolutely good conversation to have.
Yeah, so yeah, make sure you take that in consideration. So client-server affinity is required for OWA, exchange control panel, so pretty much all the web workloads, so EWS as well. For the MAPI and Outlook anyway, it's recommended, so although it will work without affinity. So some of the steps you need to do to deploy your CAS server. So as I'm sure you all know, in terms of deployment, you always start with your CAS server, then your hub, then your mailbox, hence the emphasis on the CAS preparation. So make sure you get your certificate. So whether you request the certificate internally, make sure that the root CA is trusted by your servers and your client as well. So the very basic URLs that you would need is your mail domain, your autodiscover URL. So in that scenario, for example, mail.contoso.com, autodiscover.contoso.com, and legacy.contoso.com. So back on the CAS server as well, internally in AD, make sure you update the service connection point record so that they will point to the autodiscover URL. So often we see customers forgetting of updating that SCP. So what happens? One CAS servers usually get hammered by the connection of the Outlook client, because by default the CAS server will register itself into AD with its own FQDN. So make sure you repoint that SCP to your internal load balancing. So in that case, we are assuming obviously you are using split DNS scenario. So I have the same domain externally and internally, but obviously resolving two different IPs. You can't start without upgrading your servers to SP2 first, whether it be Exchange 2003 or 7, it's an absolute requirement. You have to go Service Pack 2. I'm hoping most of you are on Service Pack 2 anyway. Then install and configure your CAS 2010 server. That's the very first Exchange 2010 server in your organization. And then start to configure the URL, so where you are going to point your different clients, so Windows Mobile, Outlook MAPI, Outlook Anywhere, OWA for redirection. So these are the URLs I've shown earlier in the deck. So they're absolutely critical for Outlook 2007 and 2010, especially to work properly, because they will rely heavily on the indication that the CAS server will send back to the client based on those information. create your load balance story. So again, that's an additional step. It's not done automatically. You have to define it. You have to give it a name. You have to join your CAS servers into that array. Once again, the boundary is the AD site. So you can't have CAS servers that are joining the same array across AD sites. So if your topology needs some sort of consideration or update, make sure you take that in mind. So if you have multiple AD site pair data center or exchange centers, make sure you take that into consideration because you won't be able to cater for them in the same load balanced array. So, and that's an AD record. So people tend to confuse the array from the load balancing mechanism. So you need to load balance the requests, but then you need to tell your CAS servers that they belong to the same array and they can work together. So that's the point of that step. Then you install your hub servers and your mailbox servers as you would like in 2007. Set up your routing coexistence. It's fairly straightforward. The hub servers is a very smart role and very simplistic. So as soon as you have a hub servers in any site where you will have a 2010 mailbox server, you'll be fine. So remember the compatibility between the different exchange versions, it's always the same version from top to bottom. So when I say top, it's CAS hub mailbox. So a 2010 hub server will only talk to a 2010 mailbox server. So hence the sequencing. If you follow the best practice, you should be fine anyway, because by the time you've deployed 2010 mailbox servers, you'll have the CAS and the hub anyway. Once again, the tools are very useful. Use the Exchange Remote Connectivity Analyzer to check your internet connectivity. One very simplistic tool to use internally is Outlook Client. So if you do a Control Shift, right click on your little icon tray, you'll have an additional option that says test auto configuration. So basically what it does is from an Outlook perspective, it will do an auto discover query and give you all the details about the URLs that are returned to your client. From an AWS perspective, from a MAPI perspective, from a UM perspective as well. So if you're not sure that your client is talking to the right server or is getting some SAN certificates error and all that sort of things, it's very useful. So make sure you use it, and it works as well externally. So if you're trying to validate your Outlook Anywhere publishing or auto-discover from an internet perspective, use that. That's very, very, very useful, and it's within the Outlook client. So the switchover. So I've explained very briefly how to deploy 2010. So now let's have a look at how do you switch. So once you're ready. So the way it works in general for all the roles is we redirect all the workloads to the newer version. So in that case, that's going to be 2010. So you will update, you will create all the records, publish the certificates, and then update your reverse proxy to publish against the 2010 servers. Then the 2010 server, the CAS in that instance, for whether it be an OWA request or Outlook Anywhere, will redirect to the right server. So if my mailbox is still on 2007, 2010 will redirect me to the 2007 CAS servers. If I'm on 2003, 2010 will talk directly to the mailbox server. So again, if you are one of these companies that has a very distributed 2003 environment and you are looking at consolidating, which you should as much as possible with 2010, make sure you keep that in mind from a networking perspective, because if you have one AD site that is internet facing and you start to redirect people, then you'll have a lot of communication cross sites from wherever is your CAS servers in your internet facing site with your backend mailbox servers. Then you reconfigure all the internal URLs, as I said, to manage the redirection and the proxying. And then you can move the mailboxes across. So it's fairly straightforward. And the 2010 CAS server is very smart. And that's across all the type of clients. So ActiveSync, OWA, IMAP, POP3, and MAPI, obviously, over HTTPS or Outlook Anywhere. So that's a bit of details on how each client will work as far as the redirection. So if I'm an Outlook web app client, so I'm a browser, that will be redirection. So you can have single sign-on redirection two ways. So if you are using 2003, or you can use your reverse proxy like TMG to do single sign-on as well. Otherwise, people on 2007 will be redirected to a new page and they'll have to authenticate again, unless you use Windows integrated auth. So again, from a user experience perspective, that's something to consider if you want to have the migration as transparent as possible. Highly recommend to do FBAs, form-based authentication, and use single sign-on on TMG to redirect people seamlessly wherever their mailbox sits. Active Sync. So from a 2007 perspective, it's an auto-discover redirect if you have a Windows Mobile 6 and above clients. Otherwise, it's just proxying, sorry. From an Outlook Anywhere perspective, an OAB download and auto-discover, that's a direct CAS support. The CAS 2010 server will provide that information directly. If you're using web services, same thing. It's auto-discover, will return the information, and then the client will talk to the 2007 server. If it's 2003, there is no auto-discover as such, so you will provide the information directly. Same goes with POP and IMAP. As I said, it's fairly transparent. It's proxying, or like the mailbox access or the MAPI access, 2010 will talk directly to the POP3 or IMAP4 2003 server. SMTP, it's the easiest role to coexist and deploy. There is no rocket science in there. These are the few steps to implement coexistence from an SMTP perspective. So as I said, you deploy your service pack 2, you do your certificates, you have your CAS, then you install your hub and your mailbox server. So some people ask the question, so when we give the steps, if you were to install a multi-role, you do everything in one go, or you could combine as well here for the hub and mailbox. So if it happens simultaneously, that's fine, as soon as it's the first server. Then you install your hub server and your mailbox server. If you have an edge server topology in 2007, make sure you reset the subscriptions to include the 2010 servers in your AD site that is connected to your edge DMZ. If you don't, then it's not a problem. You just use your SAN connectors to your smart host, whatever it might be. And off you go. So if you have updated your MX record because you want to change your 2010 edge servers, that's fine as well, and you are good to go. So the rule of thumb to remember is I need a hub transport server in every site where I have a 2010 mailbox server. Because MAPI communications are version-based. So the hub server talks MAPI to the mailbox server, so it needs to have the same version. From an SMTP perspective, it doesn't matter. A 2010 server will talk to a 2007 hub transport server. Unified messaging, again, it's a very easy role to deploy in a coexistence mode. So you just deploy the new role, you update your SIP gateway, or if you are doing direct SIP integration, your IP PBX to include the 2010 server as being the target, the primary target. Again, always the higher versions take the incoming request first and will redirect accordingly. So, and then you create a new dial plan for your 2010 users, because a 2010 UM role can only cater for 2010 mailbox server. So you can't cross functionality cross version. So I can't have, in other words, I can't have a 2007 mailbox and UM capabilities, because it's tied to my mailbox, so I'll have to move it anyway.
Safan, just a quick one for you guys who are looking at on a screen that not supported should be taken away and is supported.
Yeah, very good point. That's a mistake. So. Sorry?
With SP1.
Yeah, so with SP1, UM is supported in a virtual environment. Back to the very first best practice recommendation, we said go multi-role, don't go multi-role with UM on top of it. It's very CPU intensive, and that's not something you want to do, because that's going to break the benefit of having a single unit of scale, being able to scale out seamlessly, because the workload on a UM server is very different from the one on a multi-role servers, because you may need 5 UM servers where you need only 3 multi-role servers. That might not be necessarily the case, but just to give you an idea, so you want to spin that off separately. So yeah, you change the termination from the IPBX or the gateway, and 2010 will redirect accordingly. If you're on 2007, 2010 will send a SIP redirect to the IPBX, and the IPBX will talk directly to, or the gateway, to the 2007 UM server. So very, very easy. So yeah, just cover that. Public folders, still supported. How many people use public folders heavily? That's right. that's on par with the industry trend. So move away from public folder wherever you can and as soon as you can. I know it's hard. I know there is not many tools that can do it very easily for you and automatically, but move from public folders because public folders are still supported. They behave the same way, but as Colin mentioned earlier, your client will talk directly to the public, to the mailbox server. So if you're in a multi-role scenario, it doesn't really matter because it's the same endpoint. But public folders databases don't support DAG, for example. So it's still the old-fashioned replication topology and with all the caveats you can have around that and the management overhead. So, but it's still supported, works the same way. Little caveat, make sure when you deploy Outlook 2007 or 2010, depending on where you are at, that you enable the web services and you decommission the public folder mechanism as a way to get the free busy. Otherwise, your client will still use public folder. People remove public folder without changing the configuration, and you end up in trouble. So make sure you synchronize your Outlook deployment with this change of OABs and public folders. Free busy mechanism. In SP1, Microsoft have taken the feedback from the field, added way more options in as far as management in the EMC, in the console. Used to be mainly driven from the shell. But again, it's not as extensive as it could be. So move away from public folder. So that's a quick slide on SLAs. The point here to take away is to give you some idea and metrics on how to achieve or what it means to have 95 or 99% availability. It might be a good opportunity for you coming from 2003 to reconsider how you achieve your SLAs, if you measure your SLAs, because we come across a lot of companies that are not managing SLAs effectively or they don't have them defined. So 2010 will give you an opportunity to drive them. So instead of waiting on your business to dictate what you should be doing, and if they don't, come back to them and say, 2010 will help you to do 5 nines or 4 nines at a reasonable cost. So to move a mailbox of 1 gig, it could take 90 minutes or more. So when I want to achieve those very aggressive SLAs, how do I do that? So 2010 helps you to do that with the online mailbox move. So online mailbox move works only with 2007 SP2 or between two 2010 servers. So whether be it cross-org or intra-org. So basically how it works, the client access server will fetch the content of the source mailbox, send it to the server. So that's server-driven. It used to be console-driven, the migration and the mailbox move. So now it's server-driven. And once the migration is close to complete, around 98%, it will flick the switch, so to speak, and redirect the client. So from a client perspective, you can work on your mailbox the whole time. So you can achieve very aggressive migration targets or mailbox moves. If you need to reshuffle your mailbox or redistribute your users across the databases, you can do that in a very effective fashion and in a seamless fashion for your users. So you could patch servers on the fly during the day, and the whole maintenance window discussion takes a different perspective because now you affect your user in a far lesser manner. It's time to retire Exchange 2003 and 2007. I hope you've got the good pointers for how to conduct an Exchange migration, but it would not be complete if I don't talk about the other guys. Nodes and GroupWise and the likes of Gmail. So there is a bunch of tools that you can use. We've mentioned a few ones, so Quest and Binary Tree are in the Lotus Notes space are the major player. There is a few others, but I'm just naming a few. Again, from if you are migrating from a foreign platform, such as Lotus Notes, try to focus on the 80% of the migration, not on the 20%. What I mean by that is, I'm sure you are aware the coexistence is not perfect. It's never going to be perfect. It's two different products. They have different perspective, different vision, different understanding. Don't try to do like-for-like migration because you may not need to do that. The way an Outlook client behaves is very different from a Lotus Notes client, so don't try to replicate and go as fast as possible during the migration. The more you stay in that coexistence, the more pain you'll have. So although it might sound scary or aggressive to drive migration quick, although you have some little glitches and issues, overall, it's a lesser pain if you go quickly through that. And that's a principle I would suggest to apply in any form of migration coming from a third party a solution such as Notes GroupWise, Gmail, and iPlanet if you are still using that sort of things.
Hey, Sophia, I'm just thinking, does anyone actually have any foreign mail systems in there? You do? Actually, we're running out of time. I've only got about 5 minutes left. There's actually two more slides about foreign mail systems. We'll be around at the showcase if you guys want to come around and have a chat to us a little bit more about that as well. Just because I just want to just give everybody an opportunity to do a quick Q&A and also the prizes that we gave out. There's actually four. So the four tools I was thinking about, just to close that up, yep, was the mailbox requirements spreadsheet that both Scott and the rest of the team have actually put together. So when you're actually deploying an infrastructure, you want to make sure that you've catered for all of your considerations. If you're deploying a DAG, it goes all the way down to what sort of storage subsystems you're looking at. Well, not the actual vendor name, but in terms of the RAID and the components and how you actually spread that out. JetStress, LoadSim. I had one other from an 80 map. So there was actually four guys who actually came in there. So let me just grab the names there. It was Clint. There was Mark and Khan. I'll get you guys to come in a little later when everybody's left, and I'll come and grab it. So all those who actually sent me an email, there was four of you guys come in. You actually had most of that off the top of your head. So come in and we'll grab it a little later. But right now, I think just a couple of more minutes just to go Q&A. If you guys have got any Q&A... So does it remove your first 2007 server?
Yeah.
So the first 2007 server, not a huge issue. I think it's the last one you need to actually be worried about. Okay. And there is actually some additional information about that last server. However, having said all of that, there is actually some components that you need to move away from 2007 if that server happens to be the server containing that information, such as OAB and all that stuff. Right. So I would suggest that you look at... there is a Technic article which talks about removing the last server, and that may apply, depending on the scenario.
Right. It's a really good article. If you follow it step by step, you'll be all right.
Actually, there was a question that came in from Clint. Clint, did you want to, if you're out there, about proxying? Did you want to repeat that?
So it will actually depend if they are in the same AD site or not.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Going forward, there are occasions. Any issue you're having between the front end and the front end, because one thing I see is the front end, even though the front end panel is there, but you don't see the content.
So I don't know of any issues in terms of replicating between 2003 to 2010 per se. I mean, it works, public folder replication. There may be some corner case issues that you're hitting, and we can. That would be something I would recommend to contact support for that, right? But in general, the replication, data replication and also hierarchy replication between 2003 and 2010 works, because that's the only way you're going to get that data across in the first place.
Is there
Yeah. Yep.
I suspect the 2007 tool, I don't think there's going to be too much revamp around that. For 2010, I don't know off the top of my head. However, come after the session, we'll have a chat because I think we've got the Microsoft guys, we've got Scott, got Mario, and we can actually help you guys through that process and understand that. Because, I mean, there is a developer dedicated to that process in there, so if you've got some feedback, we can actually feed that back onto him as well. I'll take one last question before you guys go. There was a guy, no?
Yep.
What client version?
Yeah, it was
2010. I haven't.
Yeah. No, it should be okay. But why would you do that, if that's okay?
The reason why we were doing that is because we use Riverbed for our web acceleration, and we had a number of licenses.
Yeah, okay.
GC connections all the way back to our central office site was chewing up licenses when we had perfectly good GCs out of the branch.
Okay. Yeah. So the answer is I don't believe there is at the moment from as far as I know, but can I get you to send me an email and I'll double check and validate that? Yeah? Okay. All right, guys, thank you very much. We've actually run out of time, so
thank you.
Appreciate it.
You got the name?